memory of an out-of-body state. Go to sleep with some system, a wake-up system, where you are awakened, say, about 40 minutes into the time that you go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You will have, quite possibly, if you do this several times and adjust the timing of it to conform to what you do, you can probably find out much about what you are doing in that out-of-body state during sleep. Some of our people have been testing it with some very interesting results.
This is a...
I'll give you your own personal information about it.
Well, this is a good idea, and perhaps just my experience might be helpful to, well, say, Eric.
Definitely.
This thing of recalling the dreams very much, and it's something that I learned a couple of years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's to, well, first, as you said, well, exactly as you said, when I go to bed to just say, to think, to say that I will remember my dreams, that this will be a beginning, and then also I would keep a pencil and paper next to the bed.
Very important.
Right, and then immediately upon awakening, I'd write down the story of the dream in reverse order, because I could remember the most recent thing easily, and then the step before it, rather than try and go all the way back 3 or 4 hours.
Absolutely. That's indeed the best way, because it's sort of like an unraveling. The latest or last one will lead you one to the one preceding that. You're very right.
And just, well, that's it. To take it in small steps.
Yes.
Like that, in reverse order.
Very much so.
And then after I just write down it like an outline, I could go back and fill in more details of the story, and it just, because I can remember this first step or two, then the ones before that will come to my recall. And it's helpful just to do it for a time, because it's, well, like as much as we exercise our muscles, that over time it builds up. And I have found that in recent time it has come so very, very often I can remember the story of my dreams quite well, and even that's something, because I'll go down to the library and get one of these dream interpretation dictionaries,
mm-hmm.
and find that I'll look at my notes and see the dream interpretation of these things, and then I can figure out what the story was. These people who are, what, 5 years and 5,000 miles apart, but in my dream, they're just a mixture together. And then when I look at this, well, as much as we have just an outline of a story,
well,
it comes to me.
There's a more sophisticated way, and I say sophisticated in a very loose term, that you can try this, and it works even better than the writing down procedure. Get yourself a little voice-activated cassette recorder. They're not that expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is talk, and it'll record. And you can do this in darkness. You don't need to turn on the light or whatever to write. You don't need to pick up the pen. All you do is turn over slightly in bed and start talking. And it works very, very well.
I see.
And you will have a much more coherent a recording of, or reporting rather, of your dream state or your out-of-body state, because then you can verbalize it as against having to laboriously write it down.
Well, that's it, because I'll be able to just do it faster.
That's right.
Then
before it gets buried under your left brain consciousness, you see.
Well, that's it. I have outside distractions that are going to come along one way or another.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I can see me doing that, and my wife telling me to shut up.
That's what you have wives for.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
bye-bye
you sharing that with us. And we have Larry on the line. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to get to talk to you. This is an unusual program, as I don't hear you that often, and I just happen to be listening tonight. But
where have you been?
I hear you, but I just don't get you every night. But I have never called the station before, but when you mentioned this out-of-body thing, it happened to me, but I just figured out, I was telling the, who answered the phone, it's about 1952, and I had two children at the time. They were small, and my wife had gone to the movies, and A neighbor had given me a book on yoga, and I'm talking about skeptic. I've been one all my life. And I started reading this stuff, and I was getting into the meditation part, and I was sitting in a chair there in the living room reading this book, and it says then to close your eyes, and I was doing all that. And all of a sudden, I was up by the roof, of the ceiling, not outside of the house, but I could feel the heat. It was in November, and I had the heater on. I could feel the heat up of the roof, and I could look down and see myself. And I was so, my reaction was that I was frightened. And the next thing I knew, I was sitting back in the chair again. I said, God, this is weird, because what they described in this book I was reading, I didn't expect it to be like this. Now, I don't know what Mr. Monroe would say if this is a normal way that this thing occurs, but at that time, back in the 50s, if you talk to anybody about like that, it's like flying saucers. And
what's the matter with flying saucers?
Normally, back in 52, they'd lock you up. So, that's why I say I didn't tell anybody. Never have told my wife. I told my daughter here about 5 years ago, and she still looked at me like I was a little bit.
You just now told everybody.
Well, that is far more common than one would care to admit. You see, you just finally brought yours out of the closet.
Uh-huh.
There are millions of such incidents, and people are now finally bringing them out of the closet because now they're no longer worried about the label of I'm going crazy or something like that.
Yeah, well, that was just what I thought. I could actually see myself so vividly, and I could feel the ceiling and the heat from the heater, and that was what really startled me. And I didn't think, if you took a trip like in a dream, you didn't have any feelings.
Yeah, that's right. Well, hopefully the next time you can drop into that state and not be afraid of it, knowing full well that it's not going to hurt you or anything like that, and let it happen.
Yeah.
And then begin to explore it if you're at all curious.
I think the thing that bothered me was any time after that, I thought that maybe I'll go out there and never get back.
You'll always come back.
doesn't work that way.
At least I did it.
Doesn't work that way.
Well, listen, thanks a lot. I'll have to get your book.
All right, good.
All right, Larry, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
That's an experience very similar to my brother when he came out to visit me a couple of years ago and he found out what his younger brother was into.
Mm-hmm.
He confessed that he was angry at the kids and angry at his wife, and he was sort of half laying on the floor, half laying on the couch watching television. The next thing he knew, he was floating up. He thought this was fun.
Yeah.
He was up in the attic and found some frayed wires. He'd never been up in the attic. Went on down to Texas Power and Light Company where he works. Listened into the conversation of the guys down there while he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Came back, thought he was crazy. Went up in the attic the next day. There were the frayed wires. Fixed them.
That was nice.
And then proceeded to tell the guys in the control room what they were talking about the night before.
And that all makes that thing what you need for proof.
Yeah? It's there. Let's go to Gina. Hi, Gina.
Hi. I'm real new about, learning metaphysics and stuff, and I've found out I have fears. I've been told I'm not grounded. A few months ago, one night, I had been meditating, and I was really high. I'd gone to a really good workshop, and I was just kind of praying, I want to be a channel for you, talking to God, whatever. And that night, I was very relaxed, and I felt my body being pulled up, and I sort of saw like an image of my body. It seemed like in the universe, and a lot of flashes, like electricity, really strong. It felt like fireworks. And the fear part of me, I mentioned I have a lot of fear, so the fear part of me was watching it saying, oh God, what are you taking me? I thought you're supposed to be peaceful or whatever. And at the end, during the time anyway, there was this really peaceful part of me that just, it was like anything can touch me and nothing will harm me. But it was sort of scary because there was so much, like I said, flashes of electricity, fireworks. And also I think I saw like my chakras opening up. But at the end I saw the word, it said alpha. And so I wasn't really sure. Like I said, all of this is real new to me. I had heard someone mention the word alpha. But later when I spoke to some friends, they said, you were in an altered state. And I still don't know what that means. Was I out of my body, or?
It's very hard to give you an answer from the information that you you're talking about, Gina. But when I hear those kinds of things, my response is, oh, please, why don't you go and explore it some more? Because it's such a wonderful opportunity, and don't miss it. Don't miss the opportunity that you have, and don't be afraid, because there's nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, I was just like the other gentleman. I was afraid I wasn't going to come back.
But I have some very important news for you. The glue or magnetic that holds you into this physical life is very, very strong, so don't worry.
You will come back.
Okay.
You will come back.
Thank you.
All right, Gina, thank you for sharing that with us. And Steve, you're on.
All right, gentlemen, I'm absolutely in love with the notion of time travel. And my question is, if this is being done, why aren't some of the great unanswered questions being answered, such as who killed President Kennedy and why not stop Hitler before he started World War II, this kind of a thing? Why aren't the questions being answered? Why don't we know about it?
Are you saying before or after?
I'm sorry?
I say, are you asking the question why don't we explore these things?
I would think it's been explored already, or has it not?
To some degree, I think I have to give you the reason why not, which is one of the prime things. Why not find who killed President Kennedy, for example? The best description I can give you is that this appears, it's an overview that one develops that who killed President Kennedy is really not important. And that's the only way I can put it. There are so many...
Who decides that?
I think the individual decides it himself. I mean, in other words, the person who begins to work in such a field, we have a label for that. And we call it local traffic. And there are so many more exciting and interesting things to investigate and get into that you really don't find supreme interest in finding that type of historical detail. And so you really found out the truth about what happened, say, to a President Kennedy. What are you going to do with it?
Well, I suppose it's knowledge, but if there are more exciting things,
what I'm trying to get at is we have an old-fashioned phrase that we use in that type of thing, and we have the difficulty with that. Our old-fashioned phrase is that how do you keep them down on the farm? And that's the phrase, when they seem to leave, you can't keep them down there. And that's the same thing. The attraction for other more exciting adventures or information is so great that it becomes downright boring to go into that type of information exploration.
What would be one example of that, Mr. Monroe?
Well, the prime one that we all look for, and we don't really know we're looking for it, but we unconsciously look for it. We look for the prime answers. In other words, very bluntly, is there a God? Were we created? Those kinds of questions. What do we do after we no longer exist physically? This probably the most prime one present at the moment is what happens after we die? That's really, never mind anything else.
Yeah.
What do we do then?
Yeah. Are there any answers yet?
And that's much more important to you, is it not, than anything else you could find about a President Kennedy? Would you like to know what happens to you when you die?
There are a lot of questions I would like answered.
Well, that's what I mean. Let's get to the big ones instead of the things that are long gone, as it were.
What have you found happens when we die?
What?
What have you found in answering that question?
Well, we found very much that there is a very automatic and elaborate system that takes place when one passes us. The first thing that you do understand, which is a great revelation to so many people, that is that no matter what they are here now, atheists, agnostics, or whatever, that dying and surviving that physical death is a very automatic process. You're gonna survive whether you like it or not. You don't just simply turn off. And that knowledge, I think, is a thing that does alter so many people's lives. Once they know it, not believe it, not hope it, not wish it, but know it. And there's a great difference. And knowing that, and knowing the more you learn of that process that takes place, and why you do indeed return back and have another physical life, that's important stuff.
Is that like reincarnation?
Well, our studies indicate it's not quite the way it's indicated by Eastern discipline, for example. But this recycling does occur, and does occur in an uncomfortably large amount, like thousands. But that's the type of thing that gets intriguing, and you can then begin to understand why it is that we don't investigate what happened 10 years ago or 50 years ago or 5,000 years ago so much. This attracts us much more.
I see.
Does that help?
It's a start.
All right.
Yeah, it sort of boggles the mind, I think, of all of us, Steve, to begin to grasp what is unfolding for these explorers as they move out of body and into realms that are beyond their comprehension and their own, as far as that goes.
It's absolutely fascinating. If I may take another moment of your time, Bill,
uh-huh.
You had a show quite a while back on Rosemary Brown, who writes down other dead composers' music, and she was in the midst of writing Beethoven's 10th Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
This is a couple of years ago, I imagine, now.
Right.
Has she finished it? Is there going to be a performance?
I don't think it's finished. From the last I had, Beethoven has a way of coming in and erasing everything he did the day before. which is quite keeping in character with him, but she is still turning out music, quite a lot of it.
I see.
But,
thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, Steve, very good. And we have Volker on the line. Hello.
Are we here?
You're there, I think.
Okay, I'm really enjoying the show tonight, Bill, and it's really a pleasure to have Bob on the line. Bob, I have a question of you. I attended one of the Gateway Weekend programs in Los Angeles here last year, and as you know, out here, the highest we go on these hemisync tapes is the focus 12 state.
Yes.
And I'm very interested in having you folks come out here and do an advanced Gateway presentation up to your standards that you attain in Virginia there. Is there a possibility of that happening in the future here?
Well, if we could find an appropriate site to do that, we recognize very much that it's quite difficult for people in California to travel all the way to Virginia. It's difficult and also expensive. And
right. There's a whole bunch of us out here that would just love to go up to those higher levels.
Why are you living on the wrong side of the country, Bob?
Well, I'll tell you why. There's a number of reasons, and one is that I like the seasons. We've had some floods here. It didn't affect us, but not that kind of season. But there's sort of a renaissance effect when you go through a fall, winter, and spring. And I think that's the reason. I spent many years in and out of California, you know, but that was back in my show business days. So we will hope to do this, and if we can find a system whereby we can properly do it because of that very reason. It's very difficult. It's a very complex method. This our Gateway Voyage program is not that simple to put together in another site other than our facility here. And we found that if we could find some way to do it on the West Coast, we certainly would.
Mm-hmm. I can understand the setup we had here was primitive in comparison, where everybody was just spread out along the floor in their sleeping bags and wired up to the headphones there.
If you can understand the difference here, we can house some 24 people, and I house it, and I mean seeds and so on. And each one has an individual environmental chamber in which they work and they study and they go through exercises and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those are like deprivation tanks, only they're not water, of course. And you have an entirely different situation, a different environment.
Right. Right.
And we have a, we are much more concentrated here in the sense that there are no diversions. We have a, it's an intensive program, and we can control the whole environment. We're a very much pastoral. We're way out in the foothills of the Blue Ridge, and all designed, the whole facility that we built here, to do just that, is to enhance this ability of consciousness. How to do that on the West Coast, I wish we could find a place.
Well, I'll try to think up a few things to do here.
Let us know.
Bob, I wondered if you might be able to provide me a couple of quick insights that, in two difficulties I'm having when I go out of body. The first is almost every time I get the preliminary vibrations, and when I start to rise out, I seem to run into a tremendous wall of pressure that that even makes me very uncomfortable physically. And I have to get past this kind of a pressure barrier. It feels like something's sitting on my chest or caving in on me.
You should have learned a breathing exercise. And you, if you will employ that breathing exercise on a very much of a controlled thing, do you remember having an exercise in what we call resonant tuning?
Yes, yes.
We have a tape cassette of that resonant tuning, and if you are proficient enough, you can simply use that to develop this breathing system and activate it, and that will by all means release this sense of heaviness.
Oh, that's great. I have the resonant tuning tape, and I've enjoyed it when I've used it, but I haven't made a habit of it. So,
well, that's the first thing. And the second thing is that as you do begin these kinds of things, this type of practice, work into the process very, very gradually instead of trying to rush through it. Take your time.
Mm-hmm.
Most important. And if you do take your time on it, I think you will find as you do this and add to the third, in addition to taking time, do the third thing. And that third thing is that when you feel that vibrational pattern, think of it going faster. And then the way to do that is to sort of encourage it, that vibrational state, to move at a faster rate.
Right. I have learned how to do that as well.
Yeah, just get it moving faster than you can even think. And just think of it moving faster than you can conceive of.
Right. Then it turns into kind of a kind of a hum almost, and just kind of a feeling of warmth. And
yeah, exactly. And through that far, you're doing fine. All you got to do is practice it. Here I go again.
Yeah, well, you know, my second problem, Bob, is once I'm out, my clarity of consciousness is not as high of a standard as I would hope. And when I am out, I find myself doing a lot of trivial or foolish things, like testing the texture of the walls and the material, and going through the window and trying to tap people on the shoulder as they're getting ready to go to work in the morning or something, and seeing if they notice me. And I'd like to really do something more constructive, but
that's,
I seem to lack the presence of mind to be able to.
Right. That's great. Don't worry about that kind of thing. But you're doing great. All you go through those stages of testing, the going through the wall and the textures of it and the kind of stuff. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Just play around with it. That's exactly what you do. That gives you a wonderful basis in which to go moving into the other areas.
Oh, good. I'd like to know, can people write to you to find out what some of the educational applications of the HemiSync are?
Yes,
for instance,
indeed.
Is it helpful for kids with dyslexia and such?
I haven't even mentioned those at all tonight.
And, go right ahead and do it.
And it's run an extreme gamut of very productive uses, running from use in primary elementary school classroom to enhance focusing of attention, and very spectacularly. And that's been operating on the West Coast up in Washington and state of Washington, and also here in Virginia, I might add, in our own hometown, which we feel very proud about. And then at the college level, it's also been used for the same purpose. And that's in educational modes. Also, we've in one of the government training schools, we have been quite spectacular in that work in terms of increasing mental motor skills in very specific applications. And that's in the educational model. Also, moving on the other end of the scale in psychotherapy, it's a very, very fine means of accessing all the various memory and emotional and intellectual systems in a human, where you can release very much of the hidden traumas that so decimate a human personality, and those come out very nicely. Then applications in release from drug abuse has been quite productive in, oh, I would say at least 30 or 40 cases.
That's fantastic.
So there are these other things, and one of the most spectacular has been in use during surgery, where recuperative time has been cut in half, control of pain in post-surgical conditions has been even to the degree where no pain medication has been required. And this, again, is you fight the battle of the hospital, but that's another matter.
Right. Are these studies available to a non-professional person with an interest in that?
They're limited within our professional membership, but they are available to professional people, or, for example, and to your doctor, if that's the case. In other words, but generally speaking, we do not release those publicly because they are experimental use. I'll put it that way.
Oh, I see. Okay, I've been reading your book all day, and I put it down to listen to you live on the show because I'd rather listen to you as closely as I can in person rather than
the... Are you reading the new book?
Oh, I love it, and I think the implications of it in terms of the interaction of these other beings with our space-time level here is just really mind-boggling in terms of what that's going to produce in the future.
And it looks like it is, too.
Okay, well, I'll let some of the other people on now and turn off my radio.
Mm-hmm. All right, Booker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. Robert Monroe is with me. His new book is called...
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, in view that consciousness survives death, shouldn't that revolutionize our whole hospital and funeral industry? People report being aware that they're pronounced dead, being terrified that they'll be put on ice or, you know, find themselves on the coroner's table. Then think of all the people in the intensive care units with their hands tied to the bed, you know, having out-of-body experiences and then returning back into the body in this terrifying state with the tube in their nose. And, you know, just it seems that these experiences deserve a pleasant setting in which to experience the infinite unconscious. Am I getting through to you at all? Or it seems that that aspect of it is never...
How can one answer a question or a statement like that other than to say yes?
That aspect of it is never mentioned. What is that noise I'm hearing? Ever since the near-death experiences started reaching the public, everybody's been overjoyed that the death experience is pleasant. It is pleasant. But the traditional way of handling it is very terrifying. And that is the only part of it that's unpleasant. A lady reported, you know, having a near-death experience, and, you know, she woke up to find herself all tied up in a sheet and her hands all tied up. And it was only by a fluke of effort that she was able to wiggle her little toe. But think of all the others, you know.
Well, I think it would be well, Sue, if the medical profession took a little more interest in the study that Mr. Monroe and his group are doing, and others too. We'll certainly be going into that in some detail next week with Diane Morrissey.
Uh-huh.
On the near-death experience.
Uh-huh.
You might find interesting.
I'm saying a little more than that. I'm saying that our present way of handling it is reminiscent of some kind of a, you know, Dracula Tales of Horror type approach, you know, where people are,
right,
you know, the embalmer, the sutures the neck and you know. And
primitive is the word.
The primitive, right. It would scare a witch doctor. So, you know, it's a really terrifying, nightmarish thing. And other than that, the death experience has been reported to be very pleasant, but it can turn into a nightmare under those conditions. And I think, you know, that people should get behind that, you know, the right to death the way they're getting on the right to life. In other words, fuse the abortion, the right to life movement with the right to death movement.
I think you hit a very, very profound chord in our human understanding. Yes, the right to death and the right to die the way you would like to.
Right.
And I think that there is progress in that, and there are ways, for example, now that you can preset and hold in your immediate file, as it were, statements on what you want done with you and your remaining thing you've discarded called a body upon your death, or if you are incapacitated to the point where you are no longer can live in any form, that you have the right to die.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get very legal statements these days and have them ready if you enter any of those types of conditions. And
mm-hmm.
I certainly would advise anyone to do this because of the fact of what happens to you culturally if you don't.
Well, of course, emergency victims don't have...